Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. When you think of virtual reality, you may think of the 1982 Disney movie Tron, starring Jeff Bridges. David Ewald is an award-winning journalist and the author of Defying Reality, the inside story of the virtual reality revolution. He thinks we may be closer to virtual bike races than we thought.
Hey! Hold it right there!
Yes.
What do you mean, yes?
Yes.
Is that all you can say?
No.
Know anything else?
Yes.
Positive and negative, huh? You're a bit.
Yes.
Well, where's your program? Isn't he gonna miss you?
No.
I'm your program.
Yes.
Another mouth to feed.
Yes.
David, do you think that virtual reality is for real? Pun pretty much unavoidable.
I do. I think there's a lot of skepticism about it because this is a business and a technology that's crashed and burned so many times in recent decades. But the technology is here now, and it's really convincing. You know, unfortunately, it's kind of one of those you have to see it to believe it things. But people who've tried the real cutting-edge hardware and who do it, like myself, like it's really hard to deny that it's compelling and that it's real and that it's happening.
Mm. So was there something, because, as you've mentioned, you've tried a lot of virtual reality. So is there one experience, one VR experience that you can point to that really convinced you that this is legit and for real?
Well, the moment that was the real thing that pushed me over, that convinced me, was a demo of one of the prototypes of the Oculus Rift, which came out in a consumer version a couple years ago. But before it actually was released, I did a demo of that in a hotel conference room at one of these tech conventions a couple years back, and was very skeptical going in about the technology. I'd tried earlier ones, and frankly, they made me sick. That's the way that these systems usually break, is they make you nauseous.
That's not good.
No, it's not. And I'm particularly sensitive to that. So going into this experience, I did not have high hopes. But I put on that headset and really found myself transported to a different place. And that's when I realized that, you know, even if the technology isn't perfect yet, it's very convincing to certain parts of your brain. It's just good enough at this point to really make you lose yourself in it.
Wow. So that's proof of concept. If you really got sucked into that world and really thought you were in that world, that's like all you need to believe in it, I guess.
Yeah, I've kind of come to the conclusion that virtual reality works because it's speaking to a lizard part of our brains. Like, we can understand on a very conscious level, I've got this plastic thing on my head. These graphics aren't perfect. I know they're computer generated. Like, you can understand on that level, this is all fake. But the lizard parts of your brain just know, I looked around. I saw this terrain. I saw these people. That's what's happening. The lizard parts of your brain are not hard to fool. And the technology is now good enough that you can fool that part of your brain. And then you really just forget. It becomes where you are.
Yeah. You mentioned the big clunky piece of plastic that you have to wear. I imagine that's one of the things that needs to be improved, and that brings us to the question: what are some of the glitches that need to be fixed before we'll see virtual reality headsets and equipment showing up in a lot of homes the way we see TVs and the internet now in the majority of homes?
Well, comfort is one of the main issues. The headsets right now are big and kind of heavy. Most of the high-end ones have wires running off them, connecting you to a computer. You're also staring at a screen. It's a very high-resolution screen, but it's a screen an inch or two from your eyes. And so in addition to being uncomfortable on your head, it's very tiring for your eyes. And so a lot of people find that they have a hard time using virtual reality for more than half an hour or an hour, and that's a huge barrier to future adoption. But that is one of those things that the headsets will get better and better. They'll get lighter and more comfortable, and people are also researching other technologies, things like holographic light fields, where you're not staring at a screen, where there are actually photons being shot into your eyes, so it's not tiring on your eyes at all. It just looks like the real world.
And computers are going to be, it's going to be expensive for processing speed to increase. That means fancier, more expensive computers, right?
It does, but there's also some innovations that are making the computer's job a lot easier. One of the innovations that I expect in next generations of this technology is eye tracking, which is a fairly simple thing, if you think about it, that, you know, when you look at a character in VR, it would be nice for them to look back at you.
Sure.
That makes it more real.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Actually tracking where your pupils are pointing and what you're looking at makes the experience more real. But what they can also do is if they're tracking where your eyes are looking, the system can do something called foveated rendering, which is really just a super high-tech way of saying we're only going to draw pictures where your eyes are looking. So right now the computer has to render this high-definition picture across an entire screen. But if there's eye tracking in the headset, it can do a really low-resolution picture on the edges of your vision and only do high-res exactly where your eyeballs are pointing. And those kind of tricks are going to reduce the amount of computing power necessary to put you into virtual reality.
I guess there would be no point in having a staring contest with the avatar, right? You wouldn't stand a chance.
It would ultimately defeat you, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So how far back does the history of virtual reality go?
I like to think that virtual reality goes back really tens of thousands of years. I mean,
wow.
If you could make the argument going back to cave paintings.
Wow.
You go to some place like Lascaux, the cave complex in southern France, where, you know, lots of people have seen the pictures. Oh, you know, these cavemen drew pictures of bulls and all sorts of, like, wildlife on the inside of these caves. You don't realize until you're there, or if you visit it in a virtual reality simulation, but the caves are meant to wrap around you so that when you stand in the center of one of these caverns, there are animals all around you. And as you turn and look around the cavern, they seem to run around you. It's like you're in the middle of a hunt and you're surrounded by all these creatures. And that is probably what the intention was of these people in decorating these caves this way. They weren't just random drawings.
Wow.
They were trying to simulate an environment and draw people into this other world and say, like, oh, this is what it looks like to be on the hunt. So over the course of the following millennia, the technology obviously got more and more refined. But I think there's a good argument to make that everything from theater to stereoscopy and 3D images and 3D movies, like that's all part of the long, millennia-long march of people trying to create better and better simulations to put themselves into another world.
Yeah, yeah. In the early 1980s, a guy named Thomas A. Furness III comes on the scene, and you describe him as the grandfather of virtual reality.
Well, for a long time, virtual reality, or for a long time, 3D entertainment was that. It was the purview of people trying to make entertainment. But as 3D movies got better and as this sort of stereoscopic technology got better in the 50s and 60s, the U.S. military started paying more attention to it. Tom Furness was an engineer and an inventor who started working for the Air Force and started developing immersive technologies to improve battlefield experiences, which is a fancy way of saying fighter pilots would get into their planes and were just overrun with dials and gauges, and there was just way too much information. They couldn't handle it all.
Mm-hmm.
So Furness said, well, let's set out to find a way to create a better display, a better cockpit, a better interface for people to get information. And his first idea was, well, what if we have like some sort of headset? Like you could put something on people and we could just give them the bare minimum. We could show the pilots their airspeed. We could show them, here's your target on the ground. Here's another plane. By sort of closing off a pilot into this world, into a virtual world, you could control and just give them the information they needed at the moment. And so it was this idea of, well, let's create a virtual cockpit that became the foundation for, well, that needs virtual reality, that needs display technology, that needs interfaces, that needs ways for the pilot to actually physically interact with whatever's happening in his headset. And so he created a lot of these early technologies that became the modern VR industry.
Hmm. Interesting. So Jaron Lanier is the guy who actually coined the phrase virtual reality. But what role did he play besides giving it its name? What role did he play in the development of VR?
So Jaron Lanier,
Lanier
was
an
engineer, an inventor, a really really smart kid, basically, who sort of grew up on the fringes of society, kind of a nerdy kid, but also very artistic, who became really into this idea of, wow, I can create simulated things. I can make things with computers. I can create things that weren't there. And he got into this world because he was a musician. He wanted to create a way to play instruments virtually. So he started thinking about, wow, like, I wonder if we could make gloves that would allow us to strum a guitar or play a piano or something like that. And he also had a programming language based on music, and he needed a way to sort of move the musical notes around on a staff and put them in different places. And a mouse or a keyboard wasn't really up to that job, so he wanted a way to, for your hands to sort of interact with the software world. And because he was producing all this, he started sort of accidentally creating virtual reality hardware. Like, that wasn't his goal at the beginning, was not to create a VR headset and gloves. His goal was, well, I need an interface for my software and for my musical tools.
Yeah.
But it soon became obvious that, wait a minute, this is the real business here. People are interested in buying this and exploiting this technology. And so he founded a company, VPL, to start creating this technology. I say VPL because even Jaron isn't exactly sure what VPL stood for at the time. Mm-hmm. Maybe virtual programming languages. But yeah, he basically just had to invent the name of the company because suddenly he needed to have a company. But he, by creating this company that created these first input gloves and these headsets that were a step beyond what we'd seen before, this was now recognizable virtual reality. Mm-hmm. And this is what you started seeing in the 1990s. Virtual reality became a cultural artifact. It became something that we would see in movies. There was a ton of movies that came out, especially in the late 90s, that were about cyberspace and virtual reality and people surfing into the internet and controlling computers. And all that technology came from stuff basically that VPL had invented. In fact, yeah, if you watch a lot of those movies, they're wearing VPL hardware just because it looked like that was our conception of what virtual reality is. It's sure, the stuff that Jaron Lanier was making.
Yeah, Tron is one of those that have probably the earliest VR movie. What other ones are you thinking of? Do you have favorites?
Famously, one of the big ones is not a great movie, but there is a movie called Lawnmower Man, which is based on a Stephen King short story.
But it really has nothing in common with the story, does it?
The Stephen King short story is about a guy who hires a landscaper and realizes that the landscaper is actually a satyr and is like literally clipping his lawn by eating his grass.
Yeah, it's a really creepy story.
So it has nothing to do with virtual reality. Yeah. But in the Lawnmower Man movie, the plot is that there is sort of a mad scientist who experiments on his intellectually disabled gardener with virtual reality technology and exponentially increases his his IQ, makes him smarter and faster and stronger, but also inevitably psychopathic. And the Lawnmower Man enters the internet and starts killing people and taking over computers.
This is some of the most advanced computer equipment in the world, John. In these gyrospheres, we wear full cyber suits, which completely allow us to enter into virtual reality and move. Your entire nervous system and endocrine system will be in sync with the brain expansion.
Endocrine?
Endocrine. It carries secretions of certain glands like thyroid, adrenal, and pituitary, which regulate growth. Sometimes I think I've discovered a new planet. But what I'm inventing instead of discovering, I've just sighted the shore of one of its continents.
It's silly, but it was, at the time, a really iconic portrayal of, oh, you put on this suit and this headset and you go into cyberspace and you can actually move around and attack computers. And so that was a really one of the landmark films.
Sure. Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I love the story. I should see it, but I guess it's...
If you like bad movies, it's worth watching.
All right.
It's pretty crazy.
Okay, I should check it out. What do you think we're going to gain and what do you think we're going to lose when virtual reality becomes a mass market product, something that we see in almost all of our homes?
I think there's a lot to gain from virtual reality in the sense that this is a technology which will connect people in very profound ways and can give them experiences that are especially profound. Virtual reality at its best convinces you that it's real. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I've watched lots of movies, and I can watch a movie and love it and think that's a brilliant work of art, but I've never walked away from a movie and thought, like, wow, I was really on Mars there with Matt Damon, or wow, I was really fighting with the Avengers. I enjoyed the movie, and it was a piece of art or a piece of just simple entertainment, but it never really convinced me. When I've done virtual reality experiences, some of the really good ones have actually convinced me that I'm there. And then when I leave and I'm thinking about it later, my memory is not, oh, I remember experiencing that piece of media. My memory is, oh, I remember when I was in that ancient temple. Mm. Oh, I remember when I met that person in a Japanese tea garden and we talked for an hour. That didn't really happen, but the experience is real to me, and that's sort of the way that my brain processes it. These are real experiences.
Yeah, you're immersed in their world. But do you think that there is a danger that we could potentially spend so much time in virtual reality that we ignore real reality, that we're too busy, you know, we spend all this time making virtual connections at the expense of maintaining our real-life connections?
I think there's absolutely a danger of getting lost in virtual reality, but I think there's a danger of people getting lost in television and in books and video games. I know, you know, there are plenty of people who just stay home and watch Netflix all day at the expense of their personal relationships.
Yeah.
VR makes that a little bit more dangerous because VR is so engrossing, and because VR can, in a lot of ways, it can really replace real relationships or real experiences. You know, do I need to go visit Egypt if I can put on my headset and it looks just like I'm standing outside of the Great Pyramid? Maybe I really don't ever need to take that travel now. So I think in a lot of ways it is a more dangerous technology in that sense of sort of removing people from the real world. But I think like any technology, it's about striking a balance. The benefits of virtual reality, I think, are going to be stronger than the problems with it. You know, some people will get lost, but the amount of people who find new things and who expand their lives is going to be greater.
David Ewald is the author of Defying Reality, the inside story of the virtual reality revolution. You can find out more about David at WPR.org/beta.
Breast cancer awareness is the invention of AstraZeneca, one of the largest manufacturers of breast cancer drugs. That's like if Walter White had started a meth addiction awareness campaign to help people find out if they love meth.
Comedian Erin Gibson on her mission to dismantle the patriarchy, one pay gap joke at a time. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.